Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, and welcome back to the Lizelle Wellbeing Show. And today I am joined by Dr. Andrew Jenkinson, a consultant bariatric surgeon at University College London Hospital. He specialises in weight loss and diet and has been performing bariatric surgery for 16 years or more, treating over 3,000 patients in this time. Well, in listening to his patients he describes as normal people who have suffered with their weight for years, he found that what they said did not fit with his own understanding of obesity. So he set out to close this gap between what scientists, doctors, and dietitians tell us about obesity and how to deal with it, and what obese people actually experienced. Well, if the scientists are right, and it's simple to lose weight by dieting and exercise, and if the benefits of that weight loss are so great in terms of happiness, confidence, health, and finances, Andrew asked, then why can't people achieve it? Why can't people sustain weight loss? How could weight loss through dieting be so difficult that people have to resort to such extreme measures as stomach removal or bypassing surgery? Well, he is here on the show with me to answer all these questions and more. Oh my goodness, we have had the most fascinating chat about metabolism, set points, weight loss myths, including a big chat about saturated fat. I can't wait to share that one with you. And his advice for those who have spent years dieting without any luck. So without further ado, let's get right into today's show. Andrew, welcome to my podcast. Thank you for finding the time. I am so looking forward to this conversation, I can't tell you.
It's a pleasure, Liz. Thanks for having me.
Well, let us start by talking a little bit about your background and really a kind of a deep dive into bariatric surgery, what exactly it is and what do you do in the operating theatre?
So I'm a bariatric surgeon, which means I do operations to help people lose weight. Probably been a consultant now for 16 years, at first at the Homerton Hospital in Hackney, London, and then at UCLH in the last 10 years. And bariatric surgery is a type of surgery where you either remove or bypass someone's stomach in order to, you know, help them sort of reset their weight from a very high level because they're suffering with, you know, severe obesity to a more normal weight.
So you're basically stopping food from going into the stomach, is that right? So you can't actually then put on any weight?
Yeah, so it has two effects. One is the mechanical effect of either bypassing the stomach and, you know, just making the stomach much smaller. So mechanically, you literally cannot eat very fast. And that traditionally was the way that we thought it worked. But now it's becoming much more apparent that by changing the anatomy of the stomach, so bypassing it or making it smaller, you actually change the hormones going from your stomach and your small bowel to the hypothalamus in your brain, which actually controls a lot of where your weight's going to be. So it controls your appetite, controls your satiety.
That's fascinating. Gosh, so it's not just the, you know, the physical, you know, blocking or preventing of the food going into the stomach, but it's preventing the release of these hormones that are telling our brain that we're not hungry.
Yeah, this is why the sort of older bariatric operation, the gastric band, which is basically a sort of plastic ring with an inner tube that you could inflate and make it sort of tighter and tighter. So as you eat, it gets sort of more and more difficult to eat. We know that, you know, that produces a bit of weight loss at first, because obviously you can't get your money's worth an all-inclusive buffet. But it doesn't stop those signals. You know, you lose a bit of weight, but then, as all dieters know, you get a signal to, you know, to eat, and you get a signal to eat high-calorie foods. And these are all, you know, signals coming from stomach hormones. There's a hormone called ghrelin, which go to the hypothalamus and just give you this sort of voracious food-seeking behavior, which can be, you know, they're strong hormones. It can be like a voracious or a parching thirst. So we know that the gastric band, this sort of literally mechanical device sitting at the top of your stomach, is almost like having your jaw wired. It sort of works short term, but in the long term, people feel driven to have high calorie foods, chocolate, crisps, ice cream that will go through the band. And then they'll blame themselves and think, you know, it's just my willpower, doctor. But actually, yes, if you understand exactly how the body is working, it's just the normal body's reaction to a gastric band. Whereas the newer operations profoundly change these hormones. And there's three really important hormones. One is called ghrelin, which comes from the stomach, and that causes a voracious appetite. And the other two, PYY and GLP-1, come from the small bowel. As food goes into the small bowel, it's released, and it sort of tells your body to stop eating, tells your brain to stop eating. So that's the appetite break. So with these operations, those appetite breaks are on, that switch is on, and the appetite, you know, driver is off. So you're losing weight because your stomach is small, but you don't get this rebound appetite. So it just seems very, very easy.
So how does surgery control the release of hormones? I mean, this is sounding more like a sort of endocrinology issue, that you might want to have a hormone blocker, perhaps, that doesn't involve surgery.
Yes, so there are hormone blockers sort of coming along the line that are mimicking the effects of bariatric surgery, as we sort of mentioned in our little discussion before this podcast. The appetite hormone ghrelin comes directly from the body of the stomach, and that's literally removed for the, you know, the sleeve gastrectomy operation. So there is a profound drop in ghrelin, and the appetite is switched off. And it's really strange, because we do the operations by keyhole or laparoscopic surgery. So people have small little cuts. We put a little camera in, and they literally go home the next day with minimal pain. And they say to me sometimes, was it my brain that you operated on rather than my stomach, because I just don't feel hungry anymore? So yeah, there are profound changes to the way your brain perceives food, including actually changes in not just appetite, but taste. People think that, you know, sweet or sugary food seems to taste sweeter or more sugary, and processed food just tastes a bit horrible. So they literally have a craving for salads.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? Oh my goodness. It's, you just think, you know, is this something that we should all be queuing up for? You say, you know, it's a keyhole operation. It sounds relatively straightforward. I mean, is it something safe and easy that we should all be hopping down to our local hospital to book in for? You know, what's the downside of having your appetite switched off?
Well, obviously these operations are relatively safe, but there are, you know, you're removing the stomach, there's big blood vessels around. You can get complications like bleeding or leakage from where you staple the stomach. So they can be, you know, quite rare, but significant complications. So we have guidelines that, you know, the benefits of the operation should exceed the risks. So if someone only needs to lose one or two stone, you know, those benefits aren't as large as the risk. So yeah, we can sort of only operate on people with a body mass index of 35 or over. So realistically, that means sort of 16 stone for someone average female height.
It was a slightly tongue-in-cheek question that I...
You wouldn't be the first person to come who's almost normal weight. In some parts of the world, it's actually pretty normal to operate on people just slightly overweight, but not in England, not in the West.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Good heavens. That is something extraordinary. And presumably these surgeries do turn patients' lives around.
Totally. So, I mean, the average patient has been struggling, you know, for their whole life. Maybe they were, you know, size 10 or 12 as a child or adolescent and then started dieting. The book sort of tells us about, you know, the dangers of dieting, how it sort of trains your body or trains your metabolism to become really hyper-efficient. And every single diet is more difficult as you go along. And then you get to a threshold of obesity. Again, the book explains this, and we may go into it later, where leptin resistance, this the real hormonal disruption of your appetite regulation and, you know, just the regulation of your weight becomes disrupted. And then you're in real trouble. And then it doesn't matter what you do and, you know, what calorie counting diet you go on over the longer term, you're sort of stuck in that really high weight set point. And when you do these operations, people who have been dieting for years and decades just feel, you know, totally released. So, you know, an average patient, maybe 16 or 18 stone, they'll go down to maybe 11 stone, 10 or 11 stone, and not feel... A dieter will know where their weight set point is, so where their body wants them to go back to. And a lot of people, it is quite high. They're like, they're running away from that weight set point in the gym, or, you know, starving their way away from it. But once you've had the operation, you go down towards a more normal weight, and you just get this feeling that you're not, that is your normal weight. That is your new setting that your body and your hypothalamus are happy with. So it's not a constant struggle.
So let's talk about that then. So you talk in the book about this set point, and I think there are many people listening who will have been on a dieting journey and will have lost some weight that they want to lose, but then it comes back on and their body seems to be at this point, this magic number that it doesn't really want to vary from. Do we all have our own set point, which is the weight that we're meant to be? And actually, it's a bit of a losing battle to try and be anything less than that weight, because that is where we're set.
Yeah, so the weight set point theory has been sort of in circulation in scientific circles for many years. And it's based on observations, animal experiments, where they have taken rodents, so mice or rats, and either artificially overfed them or artificially starved them, and sort of put them into three groups. So one overfeeding, one normal diet, and one starving for a period of time, saw that, you know, the overfeeding ones put on weight, the underfeeding ones lost weight. But then when they, you know, let them all feed normally again, they all went back towards where their non-dieting or overfeeding sort of group were. So everyone, all the rodents went back towards their own weight setting. It didn't happen if they'd been overfed, they stayed fat, and if they'd been starved, they stayed slim. Once they're allowed to just refeed, they didn't refeed and sort of, you know, rebound up to a massively high level. They refed until they got to this weight setting. So there's a lot of evidence in sort of animal experiments. And then when you look in, you know, what is actually happening in real life with patients, and this is what I observed in my clinic for many, many years, everyone has this same story. Yeah. Yes, Dr. Jenkinson, I can lose weight on a diet, but I always put it on until I get back to where I was before the diet. And actually quite often they say they get back and then they put a little bit more on. So it's like you lose weight, put it on and more. This is really, really typical of almost every single patient who's, you know, come to my clinic, and probably resonates with most dieters. And so you sort of think, well, maybe those sort of animal experiments are telling us something about, you know, what happens in humans. And the book expands on this theory, and it really does totally explain our weight regulation system. And basically it sort of unpicks where your weight setting is individually and why it is there, and basically dependent on genetic aspects. So where your whether your family or members of your ancestors suffered with obesity, your environment. So whether you're in a Western food environment for lots of processed foods, or if you're in a food environment where there's a lot of fresh and local foods. So those two things, so genetics and environment in collaboration together, will determine your weight setting. And there's a third aspect called epigenetics, which is a little bit of a mix of genes and the environment, which is just a fascinating new area of research in, you know, the whole of, you know, human disease as well.
Yes. So is there any point really in fighting against our set point? I mean, I know for me, I can get to a certain weight, and if I want to go below that, it's a real struggle. And then inevitably, I do actually swing back, you know, to what I now perceive to be my set point. You know, is there any point in me struggling to get below that?
I think if people understand that there is a genetic aspect to where your weight setting is, so some people will, you know, be, you know, very sensitive to the Western food environment, and even if we try and eat healthily, it sort of still gets infused into us, particularly as we may discuss later, so-called healthy vegetable oils, which actually are, you know,
Yes, can't wait to talk about those.
Which is, you know, one of the massive problems with the Western diet. So some people are really sensitive to, you know, our Western diet, and some people genetically are just immune to it. They can eat the Western diet. It sort of does explain to dieters, you know, why when they live with their flatmate can just eat takeaways and rubbish all the time and never put weight on. And I think that's really reassuring to people that, yeah, people are very different, and some people have to make a real effort if they want to sort of gain a healthier weight by being much more careful with what they eat. And some people are just lucky, or maybe in the long term unlucky, because they're putting a lot of bad stuff in their bodies.
Yes, sure. They'll pay later.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But isn't it interesting, though, that, you know, leaving aside sort of the specifics, that the theory of having genes that are controlling when we feel full, and that they're stronger in some people perhaps than others.
Yes.
And, you know, there are some people, I mean, I can think of, you know, somebody who, you know, sort of, you know, nicknamed as having the greedy gene, because he just always, he loves food. His face lights up and changes, you know, as soon as he sees it. And he doesn't have an off switch. He can't switch off. Whereas the rest of us would, you know, sitting around a table with him in days gone by, would be, you know, would feel full and would stop. But he just didn't, or doesn't seem to have the capacity to stop.
Reminds me of a patient who, I was about to take his stomach out. He was severely obese, maybe 25 stone, young Australian man. But I operated on him in Dubai. And he said, "Doctor, I think that I'm going to have the biggest stomach that you've ever taken out." And he was just had such a voracious appetite that he describes having to go to two sushi restaurants because he was embarrassed by the number of plates that were built up in sort of Yo Sushi.
No,
he embarrassed and have to leave and go to this and go to the next restaurant. So, and when we took his stomach, big actually.
It does sound very, very extreme. You know, when you say here, it does sound very extreme that you, when I took his stomach out, I mean, can we survive without a stomach?
Well, if you think about it from an evolutionary aspect, maybe it's adapting the human body to the current food environment. So you're basically getting the reason that we have a large stomach is that in, you know, prehistoric hunter-gatherer times, we may not eat for several days. And when we did eat, we had to take in a lot of food, you know. So when we killed a big animal or found, you know, some plantation that was ripe, then we would have to fill our stomachs. But we don't need that when there's a Costa coffee, you know, every 15 minutes up the high street. So in a sort of cynical way, it's almost, yeah, we don't need a big stomach anymore to survive as humans, whereas from an evil.
Do you remove the whole thing or do you leave a little tiny bit then?
So the commonest operation is called the sleeve gastrectomy. So that makes the stomach into the size and shape of a sleeve. So it's like a long tube. So it's about sort of 2 centimeters wide and about 10 centimeters. We describe it as going from the size and the shape of a melon to the size and the shape of a banana. So it sort of goes from 2 liters to 200-300 cc. But as we mentioned before, it's not just the decreasing capacity of the stomach, because you can eat a load of ice cream and chocolate and still get calories in. That's not the main reason that it works. It works because it changes those switches in the hypothalamus in your brain by decreasing ghrelin and increasing these sort of satiety hormones.
So let's talk then about calories in, because this is a big part of your book. And I've written increasingly over the years about the myth of calorie counting, and that all calories are not equal, and that food is not all just the number of calories that it contains, and that our body reacts to it in different ways. What's your view as somebody who's dealt with obesity for just so many years? What are you saying here? What do you see? You mentioned right at the beginning that diets don't work, and that actually the more you diet, the worse it is.
Yeah, I mean, some people may get a little bit confused and say, well, that's just stupid, because ultimately it is, you know, it's the first law of thermodynamics. So the amount of energy that you put into your body minus the amount of energy that your body uses equals the amount of energy stored. And if you put someone into an experiment, into a lab or a prison, you know, and overfeed them, they will put on a load of weight. And if you starve them, they'll lose a load of weight. But we have a degree of free will, obviously. And this is where, you know, our appetite and our metabolism, you know, is in this battle to try and maintain our weight set point. So, for instance, in the book, we look at evidence, I think, in the first chapter, actually, of the fact that Western populations are consuming 500 kilocalories more per day now than they did 25, 30 years ago, probably 30 years ago. And when you look at, you know, the real straightforward calculations of 1 pound of weight, 1 pound of fat equated to 3,500 kilocalories. So that would, if everyone's eating as a population 500 kilocalories a day more, then everyone should be putting on 1 pound of weight per week more. And
per week.
So 25 kilograms a year. So 3 or 4 stone a year. Unless everyone's going to the gym a lot, you know, and actually doing a 10K run 5 times a week. And I don't see that happening. So something's happening. We're all overeating.
No.
But we're not putting on as much weight as would be predicted. In fact, we're putting on as a population, I think, only about 1 pound per year. Obviously, that, you know, we have an obesity crisis now because it's been going on for the last 30 years. But it's not, you know, 50 pounds a year.
Gosh, that's fascinating. So we're not as fat as we could be.
Yeah, so what happens is our bodies, it's the opposite of when we go on a diet. So most people actually overeat and should be putting on a lot more weight than they are, but their body is increasing their metabolic rate. So this is the amount of energy you burn even before you move. It's sort of excluding movement. This is what your body burns, which actually accounts for 70% of our energy expenditure. And it can sort of adapt massively. It can adapt by, you know, 700 kilocalories, you know, per day, which is a massive adaptation, which does account for this sort of lack of weight gain with the overeating of Western populations. It also accounts for, you know, the secondary effect of increasing our metabolism is that we increase blood pressure, we increase, you know, the heat of our bodies, our pulse rate. And this is actually why Western populations suffer with, well, in my opinion anyway, hypertension and cardiac disease, because they're sort of over-metabolizing to compensate for overeating. Now, if you then take that and say, well, does that explain why dieters don't lose as much weight as would be predicted? And again, yeah, that does explain it, because if you take a dieter and you look at their metabolism, and many studies on, you know, the biggest losers competitions on TV, have looked at the metabolism after profound weight loss and seen that it just really, really shrinks. And this is again, back to why two people of the same size, the same weight, the same sex, the same age, you know, we think that their basal metabolism should be similar, but it can be massively different. So one person, you know, can eat a three-course meal per day compared to the other and not struggle with their weight. Or the other person may go on a 10K run a day and the other person not, and just sit there, lay around in bed, and the other person doesn't have to struggle as much. So there are profound changes in our metabolism that explain why we don't actually fluctuate our weight much, as much as would be expected, both dieting and overeating. Mm. And that sort of explains this whole weight set point theory, this, you know, our misunderstanding at the moment of, you know, how our metabolism can adapt to overeating or dieting to protect this sort of perceived, you know, healthy weight for us.
You talk about metabolism, and obviously a lot of people, when they think about metabolism, will naturally think about exercise and being able to speed up their metabolism and affect their metabolism through exercise. How important is exercise for those with obesity or for combating obesity? Because there seems to be a lot of focus, particularly by the food industry, of, oh, we just need to move more. And, you know, but I've also heard other people say, you know, you can't run off what's on the table.
Well, again, I mean, I think Coca-Cola have been saying this for many, many years, that, it's your choice to take in this sort of fuel, and you can run it off. And again, I mean, it's the first law of thermodynamics. Yeah, if you put someone into, you know, force them to run all day, they're going to lose a load of weight. But, you know, the profound things that influence our weight set point that can be changed are the type of food we eat, not the amount of calories. So this is the book, you know, specifies three areas that we can change. So the first is insulin. The second is cortisol, which is a stress hormone improved by exercise. And the third is our, you know, polyunsaturated fatty acids, so omega-3 and omega-6, these fat vitamins. And these are the three things outlined in the book that if we change them, our weight setting will just come down. If we change them for the better, it will come down naturally without any dieting. So going back to exercise actually works, not particularly in the long term by, you know, flogging a load of calories off you, because as we know, you tend to refuel, usually in the juice bar after a workout. Exercise works by decreasing cortisol, so decreasing the amount of stress in your body and increasing the efficiency of insulin. Those two ways mean that if you do go to the gym a lot, you know, that those hormonal profiles will be improved and your weight setting will just naturally come down.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I love the way that it's all coming back to our hormones.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And if we look at sort of the Western diet and what that does to our insulin, I mean, this is it's very, very typical that, you know, the Western diet has a lot of food. So there are a lot of sugar and a lot of refined carbohydrates. So again, the book goes into the history of why we ended up with this diet that we're recommended to by scientists, which is a diet which actually is quite a high carbohydrate diet. And we're supposed to have a lot of whole grains. But in actual fact, I don't think too many people have whole grains. They have, you know, pseudo whole grain bread with a few whole grains sprinkled in, highly refined flour. So things like bread, pasta, even if it's brown bread and brown pasta, are the same as sugar as far as the effect on your insulin level is concerned. And people who have average levels of insulin that are higher because of a Western diet and because of snacking all the time on things, so the sugar content is always high. So your insulin is always trying to like get the sugar sort of out of your bloodstream. If someone has a high insulin level, their weight will automatically sort of increase. And again, going back to the book, it's a little bit like if I treated you, Liz, with insulin for a condition, diabetes or whatever, your weight setting would go up. You would, you know, put on 10 kilograms probably within 6 months. You may try and fight that by going to the gym and going on a diet, but actually your body, because your body's getting all this insulin, would want to be 10 kilograms heavier. And you can do that yourself by not taking in the calories, but actually by having a high carbohydrate and sugar diet. And this is how it works. I mean, if you know very well, if you had all the sugar and carbohydrates, that you may put on a stone or half a stone. But the misunderstanding is it's not to do with the calories, it's to do with what the food is doing to your hormonal signaling. Is to do with that insulin. So, which is why ketogenic diets work, or low carbohydrate diets we know work really well. Again, as a misunderstanding, that's to do with calories, it's to do with improving your sort of insulin profile. And again, the 5-2 or 16-8 diet, they all improve insulin profile. And these diets aren't going away, so they obviously work.
I think it would be really good to just take a close look now at the types of food that we should be focusing on. And you've talked so much about the mechanics and the science and the hormonal responses and the way the body works and metabolism. You know, ultimately, practically, we all want to know what to eat and how to eat. And I'm really pleased that you've touched on a few of my favourite words, being low carb, ketogenic, inflammatory seed oils. Can we start to unpick a little bit of that? Because I think we are increasingly aware that it's the sugars that are the baddies here. Could you just clarify for us? You said something very interesting about the carbohydrates. And, you know, even if we're eating brown bread and wholemeal pasta and these sort of so-called healthy carbs, ultimately, they just turn into sugar in the body. Is that right? I mean, is there any difference between eating a piece of brown bread or a potato and eating a spoonful of sugar?
I mean, the difference is the speed it goes into the bloodstream, but the effect on insulin is, over the long term, you know, the same. So my book sort of outlines in the one of the appendixes the glycemic load. So we have diets which look at the glycemic index of food. So the glycemic index is the speed of the sugar going into your bloodstream. But I think it's much more useful to look at the glycemic load. So the total amount of sugar in any type of food. And the index in the book looks at particularly an average sized potato or an average portion of rice or whatever. It looks at the glycemic load. And one of the sort of instructions in the book, I mean, I didn't want to write a diet book, but Penguin asked me to put another chapter in for some advice. He said it was like, you know, it would be too depressing otherwise. But I sort of thought about what would be the best thing to do. And I've seen a lot of people lose a lot of weight on the ketogenic diets, but they just put it back on because it's really, really difficult to maintain. But if you go to a low carbohydrate diet, then you're going to improve your insulin sort of levels and it's going to be doable. So, for instance, most people will take in about 300 grams of sugar in all sugar or carbohydrates, the same thing, in all of the food per day. If we can get that down, you know, to 100 grams and then 80 and 60, that will automatically just improve our insulin profile, and our weight will just come down without just by changing the type of food we eat without any type of diet.
Yes. And prevent diabetes, presumably type 2 diabetes.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And certainly, yeah. I mean, diabetes and obesity are sort of intrinsically linked. You know, the more insulin you, so the more sluggish the insulin, which is what happens with type 2 diabetes, the more insulin you need. And insulin blocks this other hormone we haven't mentioned yet, leptin, which acts on the brain to tell the brain how much fat we have. So that signal is being blocked. And you're sort of getting the opposite signals that, you know, your body doesn't know that actually you're clearly overweight or obese, but, you know, your body can't see that anymore because there's too much insulin blocking that signal. So, yeah, it's
right.
Slightly complicated.
So we want to unblock the leptin. We want to have more of the leptin and less of the ghrelin. Is that right?
So, yeah, I mean, leptin is this, again, really, really interesting concept that, I mean, it's sort of, It's passed over a little bit in medical school, and I asked sort of students and junior doctors, what do you remember about leptin? And they sort of don't really remember, but it's profoundly important to weight regulation. So, you know, normally every single fat cell will produce this hormone called leptin. And the more fat we have, so the heavier we are, the more obese we are, the higher that leptin signal in the bloodstream. And that goes to the hypothalamus, which reads it and will then adapt our metabolism and our appetite, you know, to say, okay, we've got a little bit too much energy, a little bit too much fat on board. Let's just switch up the metabolic engine a little bit and we can burn this fat back down to the set point, or the opposite, you know, if you lose weight. So the signal of leptin is really important for our body to understand, you know, how much weight we have on board. When we have too much insulin, i.e. via a Western diet, the insulin blocks that signal into the hypothalamus.
Right.
It has the same receptor in the hypothalamus as leptin. So leptin and insulin share a sort of, once it gets into the hypothalamic cells, it shares a pathway. So if you've got too much leptin, sorry, if you've got too much insulin, the leptin signal is not going to get through.
Yes.
And the analogy in the book is a little bit like if you're driving along the M1 in your car and you see the petrol gauge has gone down to zero and you sort of panic and think, oh God, I've got to like pull into a petrol station and fill up. And you try and fill up and then you realize actually it's full already. The problem is that the gas meter, the petrol tank meter is broken. And this is what happens with people with leptin resistance. And you see these morbidly obese people, really, really big, and their body cannot, you know, tell anymore that they've got 6 months worth of energy. They can starve themselves for 6 months and they won't die. They have this full fuel tank on board, but they can't see it. And in fact, they're getting the opposite signals because that leptin signal is being blocked. Their body's actually getting signals that they're starving. And this is why if you talk sort of intimately to people who are really struggling with severe obesity, they will all binge eat. They feel, you know, driven to binge eat in secret because they're embarrassed, because they think it's their, you know, they think that they're weak-willed or they're addicted to food or whatever. Actually, they've got severe leptin resistance, and that's driving them, you know, with the same sort of, you know, powerful signals as a parching thirst to binge eat every night. So once you understand leptin resistance, you sort of understand why, you know, a low-carb diet, suddenly the insulin is taken away and your body can see the signal. It can see, oh, yeah, actually, we've got too much fat on board. You know, we can see it. The engine, petrol tank is full. We don't have to keep on stopping off at the petrol station.
Yeah. So is that the number one point, that we just need to cut back on the insulin-forming foods? We just need to get rid of the sugars and go low-carb. Mm-hmm. And then we will be fixing this problem of weight gain and obesity.
So that's one of the 3 points in the book that's outlined. And it's very easy to just start that process by just giving up sugar, sweets, chocolates. And we all know this anyway, but this is why it works. It's not to do with the calories, it's to do with what it
affects. That's the science. Yeah. Sorry, yeah, that's the science. It's not just about calories, it's about this activity, our leptin meter, our hormones.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we...
That's very powerful. I think once you start to understand it, then you can also make informed choices. And if you want to have your piece of dark chocolate or you want to have that piece of cake, then it's a judgment call, isn't it? But it's just not something that you're stuffing your face with all the time and piling in breads and pastas and, you know, all those refined flours and sugars without making a conscious decision to do so because you actively want it, not because you think it's healthy or good for you in some way.
Yeah, I think it's if you understand that by, you know, really, really cutting down on sugar and refined carbohydrate and actually embracing much more natural foods, and we can talk about saturated fat if you want at some stage.
I so want to. I'm saving the best till last here.
Yeah, if we understand that actually that's just going to improve our insulin profiles and decrease our weight setting, and weight is just going to fall off us. I think, you know, if we understand the amount of sugar in various different foods as well, we can sort of say, okay, I'm going to have a load of these green vegetables. I mean, it's all common sense. We know it works, but this book explains why it works. It's not to do with the calories.
Yeah.
Calories has been a massive smokescreen for many, many years.
Very interesting. Well, talking about smokescreens, I guess that does lead us perhaps neatly on to talk about saturated fats and seed oils. And my very first book, actually, which was published 30 years ago this year, was called Vital Oils. And it was all about fats and oils. And obviously, I knew very, very little back then. And I was writing at a time of low fat, no fat, you know, was the mantra, a lot of processed trans fats, a lot of production of highly processed hydrogenated polyunsaturated sunflower oils and all that kind of thing, and butter was banned, and I just felt that was what was wrong. And even though I didn't have a strong academic background, that the number of researchers and people I was talking to at the time was really highlighting this as being wrong. And I'm now seeing so much more conversation around what are being called inflammatory seed oils. Now, what's your take on all of this? Can you give us the real deets?
I'm very similar to you, Liz. We're probably, well, I think you're a bit younger than me, but we're probably in the flora generation, this sort of, you know, artificial margarine that, you know, was replaced
by
wonderful, slightly salted butter. Because butter was going to kill us. This is what we were told. So I sort of became intrigued by the history of why, you know, our food scientists changed, you know, the recommendation to eat, you know, saturated fat and basically onto carbohydrates, which caused the obesity crisis. And if you look at it, and this is again explained in the part two of the book, which looks at the history of food, but I think in quite an interesting way. There was a big debate in the 1960s between Ansel Keys, who was a very charismatic American scientist, and John Yudkin, who was a slightly less charismatic English guy. Yudkin produced a book which basically said that sugar in our diets, this is in the 1960s, was causing, you know, heart disease and lots of different diseases. Ansel Keys had done a sabbatical in the UK, I think in Cambridge for a year, and had seen, you know, the way we eat fish and chips and, you know, Sunday roast and lots of oils and things. And his thesis was actually, it's the cholesterol in saturated fat that's causing heart disease. So they had a big debate actually for many, many years. And in the end, the sort of debate was, you know, won convincingly by Ansel Keys, who came out with this, you know, really seminal study called the Seven Countries Study, which basically looked at the amount of saturated fat or cholesterol that various different countries consumed and plotted it against, you know, the amount of heart disease that that country had. And there was this fantastic correlation. Absolutely perfect. And this sort of ended the debate. It was like the food scientists were scared. It was like, okay, well, we better tell the food industry, you know, that you're killing the population because there's too much saturated fat in the food. Subsequently, many, many years later, after the damage had been done and we had, you know, been told saturated fat was going to kill us, this study was found to be flawed because actually Ansel Keys went to 27 countries and not 7. And if you look at the actual plot of 27 countries, it's just totally random. And he just picked the 7 that collaborated.
The 7 that matched. That's sort of like, appalling.
It was.
Did he really do that? Yes. I mean, that is clinical fraud on a massive scale.
Yeah, which, I mean, in the old days, you were sort of allowed to just exclude things or just not publish a study. It's only been in the last...
I mean, I do know that a lot of, you know, dodgy dealings goes on in medicine and studies and, you know, deciding what results to publish and what not publish. And, you know, I have to say, since... you know, writing for my magazine and looking at various numerous flawed studies that have gone on around the globe, it is terrifying how simple it is to manipulate data.
I mean, this data
and
was
to change public opinion.
And that those sort of scientists were funded by the sugar industry. So they were paid by the sugar industry. There was another, you know, seminal review article which was published in two parts in a really high impact journal, I think in around about 1980, which, you know, hammered the point that, you know, saturated fat was terrible. And basically, they again cherry-picked various different studies that collaborated with how they thought, and they were paid. But again, in those days, they didn't have to disclose who was paying them for this information. Now, so the scientists were in, and the food industry actually were in a bit of a dilemma. So basically, the food industry and the scientists told us to eat more grains, which is why we have more carbohydrates, which is why the population became fat. But we had a problem in that, you know, food that had saturated fat taken away just didn't taste so good. So they had to sort of replace it. So they eventually replaced it with all of these sort of seeds that would have been thrown away or used for animal feed. So cotton seed, you know, canola seed, various different seeds that they were able to refine like a crude oil. The amount of, you know, processing that these oils take to produce is terrifying. And they produce this sort of perfect human food, which actually is pro-inflammatory, as you found out many, many years ago, Liz. But also, I think, you know, the book looks at, you know, in detail at what the seed oils, which have a lot of omega-6, do to our bodies as far as not only inflammation, but, you know, again, going back to insulin signaling. So if you have a diet that's infused with vegetable oils, and the Western diet is, because, you know, it's not just fast food from McDonald's that's got a lot of vegetable oils, it's fried in, but actually most processed foods have got vegetable oils in there because it's very, very stable. It doesn't go off. Anything in a jar will have a lot of vegetable oil in there. And these type of oils...
So are we looking at things like palm oil, for example? And, I mean, what are the ones that we should be really looking out for on the,
palm oil is a saturated fat, Liz. So palm oil is the only saturated fat that I would say is particularly dangerous. It's been shown in many experiments. It's a bit of an artificial saturated fat. It shouldn't really be in the human food chain, but it's been, again, sort of manipulated. And it finds its way in cakes and biscuits because, you know, it's so easy to use, apparently. The consistency of it is easy to use in baking.
Yes.
So palm oil, unfortunately, because it has infused into the Western diet, is used by the opponents of saturated fat to say, yeah, actually saturated fat does cause heart disease. It's not natural saturated fats like in your beef joint or whatever, or in your butter or dairy.
Yeah.
That causes heart disease. It's actually the palm oil in so there's a lot of, you know, a lot of, you know, the real truth is obscured by
oh yes, obfuscation and the muddying of information and misinformation. And, you know, the food industries, like any big global giant, where there are huge amounts at stake, you know, we're talking billions, if not trillions, you know, there is massive vested interest isn't there? And I'm always shocked at the manipulation of data. That's really good to know about that, about palm oil. But looking at the seed oils, the ones that we should avoid are what? Things like sunflower seed?
So basically the book looks at these two. So the seed oils are polyunsaturated fatty acids. And these are, and there is two particular types that we've heard of, omega-3 and omega-6, which we can't produce in our bodies. So they're like fat vitamins. We have to take them in from our diet, otherwise we'll get ill. Omega-6 is the thing in seed oils. And it should be in a sort of ratio to omega-3 of either 1:1 or 1:4. So historically, that's the sort of ratio that we would take in. Omega-3 is in fresh fruits and green vegetables, and in algae and things that eat green vegetables and algae like cattle and fish. So that has a lot of, you know, omega-3 in it, which is why we always say like fish is great for us. But unfortunately, the omega-6 in seed oils just totally sort of obscures and dilutes down any omega-3. Even if we have omega-3 supplements, the amount in our, you know, vegetable oils and processed foods totally sort of drowns it out. And on a cellular level, if you have a high ratio of omega-6, it does cause inflammation, Western diseases, and sort of inflammatory Western diseases, and also sort of interferes with insulin signal, which ultimately leads to higher insulin levels and obesity. So again, this is why the Western diet, not just sugar and refined carbohydrates, but also infused with seed oils, all cause obesity, not to do with the calories.
That is so fascinating, isn't it? And I'm such a believer in getting back to natural foods. I cook with lard and dripping because it's very stable. I use a lot of olive oil. I'm a massive fan of butter. And a lot of the things I've been writing about more recently are things like gut health. And actually looking at the role of butyrate in butter is really fascinating, and about how it's strengthening the very fine epithelial cells.
And these are natural foods. These are natural foods that have been around for hundreds of years before we had an obesity crisis. Only the new foods, you know, the refined carbohydrates and the vegetable oils that, you know, we're not used to them as humans, and it causes major problems.
But alas, you know, very little money to be made out of selling us blocks of lard or even, you know, butter or straightforward things like eggs. And I did a podcast not that long ago. Actually, there was a study that was released that said that 2 eggs a day were leading to diabetes. And I thought, how can that be? That's just ludicrous nonsense. So I got in touch with some leading academics on the subject, and we did a really interesting podcast about it. And they unpicked the data, and it turned out that it was to do with women living in rural China. And actually, when you examined the data and you made all the allowances for all the variations, actually, it wasn't the eggs. It was the number of cakes and biscuits that these women were eating.
Yeah, I mean, but there's so many of these, you know.
That didn't make the headline. What made the headline for, you know, the tabloid newspapers was, you know, don't eat eggs because it'll give you diabetes. And you can bet somewhere that there will be some PR agency or somebody at work who will have spun that story into the media. Never mind, I'm not going to have an egg, I'm just going to have a bowl of breakfast cereal or a packet of biscuits, because eggs are
healthy. It's sort of like, I thought it gave you heart disease. Oh no, it's actually diabetes now, but actually it's neither. But the perception is that, you know, saturated fat, most people and most doctors still say saturated fat increases your cholesterol and, you know, causes a big risk of you know, keeling over with a heart attack at any moment in the future. But again, when you look at the research, it just doesn't pan out, and it's terrible dietary advice.
And that is it for today's episode. Huge thanks to Dr. Jenkinson and his book, which I have to say is completely brilliant. So interesting, and it's a really enjoyable, good read. It is called Why We Eat, in brackets, Too Much, The New Science of Appetite. And it's all about help for understanding why we have been struggling with diets and they simply don't work. It is a really, really good read. I cannot recommend it highly enough. And as always, you will find a lot more information over on lizarwellbeing.com. And there you can sign up for our free weekly newsletter. It's filled with healthy, balanced recipes, including lots with lovely, good quality fats and more tips for living well. Well, huge thanks to all of you who have left us such lovely reviews. It's a pleasure to read. Thank you so much. It really does help others to find the show, which I am so excited about as we spread more good news. So if you are able to leave us a quick review, essentially iTunes is the place to go to leave comments and reviews. And if you can click those little 5-star rating buttons at the end of this podcast, that would be hugely appreciated by both my team and me. So until the next time we chat, go well. Bye-bye. The Lizelle Wellbeing Show is presented by me, Lizelle, with production by Amaryllis Earle and Harry Trevithick at Heart Dialogue, with thanks to my producer, Ellie Smith, and guest booker, Millie de la Morinière.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.